We've been looking the last couple times at his spiritual corrective, and we continue to look at that, concentrating on three passages in the book, Judge for Yourself, and looking at an entry from the journal on a related matter. And then added to this, we're going to try to look at some of his material on joy. All of these items are connected. The single journal entry on the importance of disgust in the life of the Christian is connected with his understanding of joy. I think a proper understanding of Christian joy can reside in a Christian's life unless they have the right understanding of disgust for life. And the three passages that we're going to look at in the Judge for Yourself also tie in those themes of joy and disgust. So I hope all this will kind of fit together, and it won't look like a scattering of clippings, but rather a painting of a picture. It all kind of take form. So here we are then on our third session, and my name is Ron Marshall, I'm a Lutheran pastor in Seattle. I think I'll still have that job when I get back, I'm not sure. But so what I'm going to do is I'll hand these out. It's the little slip from the journal, and then the business on joy. And then we'll get started first looking at Judge for Yourself, and then we'll get to these. We are coming upon my three favorite passages in Judge for Yourself. I said in the first class, I think every Christian should have this book in their library. There's nothing like it. There's just nothing like it. Now, I haven't read everything that's been written in Christian literature since the time of Jesus, but just about. And there's nothing like this book. This is a tremendous... Judge for Yourselves. There are copies available in the bookstore. It's a paperback that costs maybe $8, $9. I don't know. Okay, the first text we want to look at is on the matter of persecution, the persecution of the church. And it starts on page 153 at the bottom. Yes, indeed. One is so ready, and this doubtless is the way to become the darling of the Christian public, so ready to lay the blame on the preachers of Christianity. This is kind of a curve, as Kierkegaard has been attacking the preachers and the bishops. Bishops more than the preachers, but he really goes after the leaders of the church. And here he says, that's a cheap shot. It's kind of, yes, indeed. One is so ready, and this doubtless is the way to become the darling of the Christian public, so ready to lay the blame on the preachers of Christianity, to seek the defect in them. And yet perhaps it is rather the Christian public which would compel the preachers by the fear of men to deceive this Christian public. The world, which in every field requires security, has also taken pains to secure itself against Christianity, becoming through its preaching a power which has the right to put a man's life under obligation, and hence this world requires the reliable security that the preacher's life make preaching a punching of the air. Nothing more than that. And then over on 154, for to say it short and sharp, this is the very definite utterance of the New Testament, that Christianity and the fact that one is truly a Christian must be in the highest degree an offense to the natural man. Kierkegaard was very preoccupied with those. There's just a few of them. There's three or four passages in the New Testament that talk about the offense of what Jesus is doing. Blessed are you if you take no offense in me. And a couple others, really. But he dwelt on those passages because he didn't see anything in the Christianity of his time that was offensive. Okay. And I was especially surprised in the Lutheran church that wouldn't be there, for Luther is the one who taught us that the law is offensive and the gospel is offensive. The law is offensive because it asks us to do something we can't do. And the gospel is offensive because what it gives seems to be not enough. So both are offensive, and he didn't hear that word at all. And so it wasn't surprising to him that the church and the life of the Christian wasn't an invigorating event, because its nerve had been cut, the offense had been taken away. So he says, to say it short and sharp, this is the very definitive utterance of the New Testament, that Christianity and the fact that one is truly a Christian must be in the highest degree an offense to the natural man, that he must regard Christianity as the highest treason and the true Christian as the most scurvy traitor against humanity. A treason and a traitor which never can be punished severely enough. It is also easy to see that Christianity, being the thing which defines man as spirit, must so appear to everyone who has not by dying from been reborn as spirit. Okay, it's important that the offense of the Christian message be retained. If you take the offense out of it, you lose the faith. And the thing that is offensive to the faith is that it's treason against humanity. It doesn't coddle the human. It doesn't let you keep everything that properly resides with being a human being. All the things that you love the most. All the things that you most naturally come by. It takes them away from you. So it's treason against the human being. And that's offensive. But it's the heart of the Christian message. Now he says, I don't see it anymore in the church. I don't see it in the life of Christians. And I read this and I say, no wonder you didn't see it. Who would want it? And certainly it's not seen now either. We can raise a historical point there and say, is he right? Is that the intention of the Christian message? To be a treason against humanity? And to take away from us all those things that we most naturally come by as human beings? To ask us to give them up? To give up our possessions? To give up our affection for our family? And to give up our lust for war as a way of dealing with our enemies? To take one triad that comes out of the New Testament? Is that really what it's about? Or is it telling you, you can have it all? The Burger King of religions is Christianity. You can have it your way. Isn't that what it is? That's what it is. Yeah. Kierkegaard's probably wrong. Then on 155 he says, we extol our age for the fact that Christianity is no longer persecuted. We extol it. Why? There's been progress. Isn't this wonderful? America. Not just Denmark. America. You can be a Christian here and not be persecuted. That's a sign of the progress of the Western world. The world woke up and said, yes, Christianity is a lovely, wonderful thing. Let it flourish. We extol our age for the fact that Christianity is no longer persecuted. That I can well believe. Christianity doesn't exist. If it existed in its true form, persecution would instantly persecute this treason against humanity. The average man, the class to which I belong, will have enough sense of truth to be disposed, to be willing to have it made clear, if it can be, that what we call Christianity is not properly Christianity, and then also to be willing to be convinced of it. And if nothing more is exacted of them, to admit it. For if what is exacted of me and of others was simply that we should really become spirit, have the mind of Christ among us, what he means by that, then doubtless we should all of us become in the highest degree embittered. But we don't want to be embittered, and so we don't have it. We don't have the mind of Christ among us, he would say. The word on persecution. For the spiritual corrective here, the element in the spiritual corrective that he's providing is, the one we're looking at now, is that persecution is indispensable for the life of the Christian and the life of the church. If there's no persecution, the heart of the faith is gone. It's gone.
The other day I asked you if he was running for martyrdom.
Well, there's different forms of persecution. One, of course, would be where they line them all up and shoot them.
Well, you don't have to be shot to be a martyr.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Now, he has different senses of martyrdom. We're going to look at that. He thinks ridicule is martyrdom. And that's the form of martyrdom that he suffered, he believes.
I don't see how you can say the things you just put in yourself without seeking martyrdom.
Well, I think there's a difference between seeking martyrdom and trying to identify what the character of the faith is that we confess. See, I want to characterize what the nature of the faith is that we confess. What is the Christian faith? That's one thing to do. And in his characterization, he's saying persecution is a part of it. Now, on the other hand, there could be a person who's kind of hell-bent on self-destruction, and that person is just looking for a chance to be persecuted. Now, that's a different kind of an operation. His operation, I think the way he understands what he's doing, is that he's trying to describe what the nature of the Christian faith is. And he sees from an examination of the New Testament and from the early history of the church that persecution is an indispensable element. And it's all the more clear to him when he compares it to his church in 19th century Copenhagen, where there's no persecution. Yeah, if he were to align himself with the church.
No, if he were to align, if he were to become what he thinks the church should.
Right, right. Then that persecution would have to be part of his life.
Yeah.
But I think then you could go kicking and screaming. That's different than the one bent on destruction, pursuing it.
Not
you could say,
for persecution.
No, saying, this is regrettable, but this is the calling. I wish it were otherwise. It's kind of like Jesus in Gethsemane. If you can remove this cup from me, you've got my permission. If you can figure out a way that we can get this work done without me dying, an ignoble, you know, a death of ignominy, then go ahead and do it. I have nothing at stake in dying, that kind of, but your will be done. It's that kind of a thing. That's important. Should have been said up front. So thank you for bringing it to our attention. The next element that I want to add here is a text that was one of his most favorite in the New Testament. And this introduces another element into the spiritual corrective. We're moving on now from persecution. You may have thought we never left. All of this has been persecution. But we're moving on to another element. And it's the matter of single allegiance. Kierkegaard has a book called Purity of Heart is to Will One Thing. Purity of Heart is to Will One Thing. And that's this business on single allegiance. If you don't have single allegiance, then the mind of Christ does not flourish among us. In describing the character of the Christian faith, single allegiance is indispensable. It's another indispensable trait. And, of course, the text is when Jesus says, you cannot serve two masters. Okay? So that's the text we're going to look at. And that's on page 171, where he amplifies this. Now, this is one of the most creative, I think, amplifications of that text. You can only serve one master. You can't serve two. Now, for the preachers among us, just imagine how you could preach on this text and look at the way he approaches it to make that point. Jesus let himself be born into poverty and lowliness. And not this only, but in despicable condition of a betrothed virgin to whom the upright man who was betrothed to her showed a kindness in not putting her away secretly, which at first he proposed to do, and which itself would have been an act of forbearance. So it was that Jesus came into the world. In such wise he remained outside the world, cast out of the world by his very entrance into it, without father, without mother, without descent, by his birth not connected with any man whatsoever. But thus it behooved him to be early attentive to what his life was designed to express, only to serve one master. Just as he who is to contest in a race is dressed accordingly, just as he who is to strive in battle is armed accordingly, so is his life from the very beginning adapted to make it possible only to serve one master. For birth, and it need not be birth of scion to an ancient noble house or of an heir to the throne, but birth itself, when through it a child becomes a member of a family, birth itself is a bond which at once unites this human individual with other persons in close connection, and it is connection with the world and all that is of the world, and so, too, connection with other men, which makes it so difficult only to serve one master, and makes this impossible if the connection is not broken, albeit love remains. On the other hand, the illegitimate child, knowing nothing of race and belonging to none, excluded from society, brought to birth at midnight behind a bush by ones whose pregnancy was concealed. So it was he let himself be born, because there was no room. So also he was crucified, because the world had no room. He was born in a stable, for in the case of the despised maiden, there was no family connection with a layette in readiness. Where were the stewardship sewing guilds when we needed them? No layette in readiness, laid in a manger. If there is any question of his connection, it must be with the horses. Only serve one master. He sees that message being proclaimed in the way Jesus was born. He said the way he came into the world, he was cast out of the world. For he was born, he came into the world as one who was on the margins, wasn't at the center. You think of Luther's commentary on the Magnificat. You know, he says, why wasn't Caiaphas' daughter selected to give birth to the Savior? He goes, oh, I don't have to tell you, he asked that question. Why didn't God choose her? I bet she was a lovely young girl. He goes on and on about her. She could never be the mother of the Lord. This one who came to die had to come by way of the margins of society, being born to one who was not of noble lineage. Can only serve one master. Everything in us says, no, I could serve three masters, I bet. You see? You know how you do it? You set up priorities. That's how you do it. You say, well, I've got God at the top and then my wife. And then my ordination, and then my children, and then my country. You know, how you got all set up, you know, myself. I can juggle all those things together. I can serve more than one master. All you have to do is just get your priorities straight. It's not going to dilute my allegiance. I can be as passionate about my faith in the one who is among us, who is holy, and who made us and died for us. I am as passionate as that one with all my other allegiances. Give me a chance. Watch me. I'll show you. You can only serve one master. And he sees that message being proclaimed in the very way that Jesus was born into the world. And that is reinforced for us the life of the faithful one. It's an indispensable element. An indispensable element. I have a good friend in the seminary. He's a pastor up north of Spokane. And when he writes letters, he signs them, may the pension plan be with you.
Oh, no.
And we all laugh, you see. That's funny, right? Well, no, not really. Not really. Who do I serve? Take my money away and see how long I remain a pastor. Single allegiance. Now, this may be the heart of the book, page 208 and 209. It's the last one. What is spiritual apathy? Here we're going to talk about the standard for the faithful, that which the disciple holds up as that to which they aspire. Kierkegaard calls it the ideal. As this is an indispensable element to having the mind of Christ among us. What is spiritual apathy? Are any of us interested in that today? Any church members interested in that? How many people do you have on the rolls? My church, we have 900 people on the rolls, and we get 350 worshiping each Sunday. And of the 900, we see them, most of them, about 800 of them once a year. And we see all 900 of them once every 2 years. We ought to get greater participation. What is spiritual apathy? It means to have the standard changed by leaving out the ideals. It means to have the standard changed to correspond with what we men who now live in this place actually are. The whole of Europe may be bourgeois, and a little out of the way provincial town may not be. All depends upon whether the true standard is used. But sensual well-being is no friend of the ideal standard. Here we see why things have gone backwards in Christendom. It is because they have abolished imitation. And not even employed imitation to exert pressure on believers. This being the exact reverse of the Babylonian revolt against heaven at the Tower of Babel. The exact reverse. For that was a rebellious attempt to take heaven by storm. The other is an attempt to get rid of heaven and the ideals by a disclaimer made in self-conceit and self-contentment. What the requirement of Christianity is, skipping over to 209, what the requirement of Christianity is not a fixed thing. It depends upon what sort of people one lives amongst. Instead of imitation, what one really gets is the notion of being what people for the most part are. And to be a little better is to be great. But when the price of becoming a Christian is so cheap, then comes idleness. Then comes doubt. And then the real truth comes to evidence that one cannot conceive why Christianity need be. And that is perfectly true. For if the requirement is no greater, then a Savior, a Redeemer, grace, become fantastic luxuries. And insofar as one does not let go of Christianity but continues to make movements in terms of it, one becomes as ridiculous as a child who wears his father's clothes. What Christianity presupposes, namely, the tortures of a contrite conscience, the need of grace, the deeply felt need, all these frightful inward conflicts and sufferings, what Christianity presupposes in order to introduce and apply grace, salvation, the hope of eternal blessedness, all of this is not to be found, or is to be found only in burlesque abridgment. At bottom, it is sheer superfluity, which at the most one imagines the need of. And so in the end, one becomes tired of Christianity. For the pressure of imitation was lacking. The ideal, Christ the pattern, is lacking. Where does apathy come from? Apathy comes from lowering the standards on what it is to be a Christian, and everybody gets tired of it. It's got to sit around and yawn. There's really nothing here. No, you're not going to say that, though. We're not going to say that, though. There's really nothing here. I mean, what is the need? Well, I really don't have a need for it. I preached a sermon once on Amos, where Amos says, God took me from tending the sheep in Tekoa and sent me up north into Bethel, into the temple, and there I spoke against the priests, the leaders. Isn't that interesting? Amos thought he was just took. He said, why are we here today? Why are we in church today? There's probably all variety of reasons. We're here because I'm the oldest child and I still suffer the instruction of my mother and I've got to be responsible. And if all my siblings quit going to church, I at least will remain faithful. And I'm here because I'm the oldest child. Or I'm here because it's some kind of fire insurance for the end. I don't want to roast eternally in hell. And so I'm Pascal's wager. It may not be true, but what the hell? I'll give it my all, and just in case it's true, so that I don't get burned up in hell. Or I may be here because I believe Psalm 37, verse 4. If I delight in the ways of the Lord, he will give me the desires of my heart. A BMW. I'm in church so that I will be a success. Maybe I'm here because I hate myself. And I like to be tortured listening to sermons every Sunday. So then I said, no, we're here because God brought you. That's why you're here. Just the same way that Amos. You're not here because you figured anything out. You're here because God took you. You've all been taken. Well, afterwards, the conversation was really quite interesting. People had genuinely worried why they were in church. They were worried about parental influence. They were worried about, am I really there because this I believe is the right thing to do? Am I really here because I feel a need for this? And that the need that I feel is a legitimate need. It's not a simpering need. It's a legitimate need. And I'm not sure it is. I'm not sure I have a legitimate need for being here. See? Kerr says, we don't see the need for Christianity. If the presuppositions aren't there, what does he say they are? The tortures of a contrite conscience. Who wants to be tortured by a contrite conscience? We got everybody in our society telling us that guilt is a waste of time. Right? The guy who's written the book, Pull Your Own Strings, and I mean, that guy, how many books has he sold? Hundreds of thousands of books. People really, guilt is a wasted emotion. It does nothing for your self-development. The tortures of a contrite conscience. If you don't have that, you don't see the need. And yet he says, maybe still, well, some of us will stick around anyway. We don't see the need, and we'll just play the game. And everything will be in a burlesque abridgment. Really quite insightful. I don't know what your life is like, but I would guess we're not that different. And I see myself all over these pages. It has to be expensive. If it's not expensive, it's a waste. Now, a book was written a few years back called Why Conservative Churches Are Growing. Some of you may have read that book, and I think it's in its third edition now. And one of the things the author argues in that book is that the reason the conservative churches are growing is because it's costly to be a member. And it's important, I think, for us in looking at this text to disassociate Kierkegaard from that analysis. Because the problem with that analysis is that the cost of being a Christian there is, I think, a works righteousness cost. And Kierkegaard was just too much of a Lutheran to be into works righteousness. He believed there was a difference between being a Christian and being a disciple of Jesus. You can be a Christian and not follow him. Have you ever known someone like that? Now you know someone like that. I am a Christian because I was baptized. I was adopted into the family of God, but I don't follow Jesus. Kierkegaard believed that was utterly possible. And so, if you raise the cost of what it is to be a Christian, for Kierkegaard, what he's saying is, I'm raising the cost on what it is to follow Jesus. And so the stringency of it all, the severity of it all, does not compromise that one becomes a Christian through adoption. What it will compromise, though, is our self-inflated estimations of our discipleship. He is puncturing the balloon of our estimations. Well, of course I follow my Lord. Of course I do. Say, look again, Ron. Look again. And what standard have you used to determine whether or not you're following your Lord? I dare you to use the New Testament. So, the raising of the cost is not designed at all to raise the cost of your eternal destiny. That is in the hands of the grace and mercy of God. But what he is raising the cost for is what counts as following, deeds of following Jesus. Okay, he really believes there is a difference. We may not accept this. But he really believes there's a difference between being a Christian and following Jesus. The way one is a Christian is through the adoption of the grace and mercy of God. Through baptism. That's good Lutheran doctrine. Kierkegaard's a Lutheran. But that's not the same as following Jesus.
Does he see any merit in being a Christian, quote unquote?
Sure, I mean, your eternal destiny is wrapped up with that.
You don't have to follow Jesus.
No. Yeah. And we'll see a point-blank reference to it in tomorrow in for self-examination. He said, that there's a difference between grace and ethics. Grace means your adoption, your identity into the family of Christ. But the ethics, the following out, we could maybe call it the life of sanctification. There's a stringency to that that we have shrewdly eliminated because we can't bear the force of it. And he's asking it to be reintroduced.
But is he saying grace is sufficient? Works are just something else.
Grace is sufficient for your eternal destiny, the grace and mercy of God. And works are utterly indispensable for the discipleship of the Christian, for the sanctification of your justified life. And this, he believed, was an elaboration or even maybe a correction on Lutheran doctrine. Because it's pretty hard to get an elaborate ethic out of Luther. Luther was so preoccupied with how one's identity is established, how one becomes a Christian, that he didn't spend a lot of time on the life of sanctification. And it may have been because of his time. He so much reacted to the occasions. And he and Thomas Munster had just one hell of a time getting along with each other. And Munster was pretty much the leader of the Anabaptist movement, which the heritage of the Anabaptist movement are the Pentecostals today. And Luther just thought Thomas Munster had his head up where the sun don't shine. And he had these horrible sermons, vitriolic sermons, addressed against the Anabaptists. And the famous one that been popularized in our time quite a bit is, they said, the problem with the Anabaptists and Thomas Munster is that they think they've become so spiritual that they've ended up swallowing the Holy Spirit, feathers and all. Can you just see the picture? There you are, the feathers staying in your mouth. Look at me. So Luther was afraid of that area, or not, maybe not afraid of it is the right thing to say, but found it to be very unproductive. And so it really isn't a fully developed feature of his theology. Kierkegaard is trying to supplement that. Okay, so it's important to see that this raising of the cost, so that we aren't all walking around like a bunch of little kids with our father's clothes on, playing a game, trying to live with something that doesn't fit us because we're not willing to be the size that the clothes require. So we all look around, so ridiculous as that. And start measuring yourself by this stringent ideal. Now, in order to get that stringent ideal in place, there has to be renunciation. Because the thing that distracts us is the temporal world. The reason that we don't want those high standards brought to bear upon us on what it means to follow Jesus. You know, I talked about those, the three, you know, the one way of rendering. We're going to look tomorrow at 90 of the sayings of Jesus, just from the Gospels that are attributed to him, that are hard sayings, that we just soon never hear again. But you could pick three out of there, you know. Our lusting for war is a way of dealing with our enemies. Our hoarding of our possessions and money. I have an Episcopalian priest down the street from me who was just thunderstruck when he found out I had a savings account. Couldn't believe I had a savings account. I said, I've got children. I mean, I've got responsibilities. So I have five kids. I've never had a savings account. I said, what are you going to do, Ralph, when you retire? So I'm going to live in low-cost housing somewhere. He said, I can't imagine. Christians should never have a savings account. Not when there are people starving in the world. He said, but you do what you want, Ron. It just surprises me. Surprises me that you would be like that, hoarding your money. The way we hoard our possessions. I mean, God looks down on me and he says, you must not have read Psalm 119, that we're just sojourners here, Ron. You look like you're a Hindu or something. You must believe reincarnation, because the only way you can ever read all the books you have is that you're going to die and come back again. Or to wear all the clothes you have. Or to use all that crap you have that's piled up around your house. I mean, you can't do it in one life. You must really believe you're dying and come back again. You'll have it all there ready for you. We hoard our possessions. And then the preoccupation we have with our family. I die for my kids. You're big. I die for you. Die for Jesus? Pardon me. That would be a waste. I mean, I have all these resources and talent, you know, I'm going to die for Jesus. I mean, I can use it. I can preach. I'll preach for Jesus. Well, I ain't going to die for him. I mean, you know. Jesus had all these attacks on the family. Look at America today, you know. Preserve the family. And everybody's just running to line up, you know. Yeah, preserve the family. Jesus said, I came to set mother against daughter, father against son. And if you're not prepared to hate your mother and your father, your brother and your sister, and your even yourself and your wife, your husband, you're not fit to follow me. Well, heck, is Jesus interested in preserving the family? Oh, we don't preserve the family, the country's going to fall apart, right? The family is the heart of the country. We cling to our family. We worship our families. And why is Jesus against the family? He's not against the family because families are bad and we should all be celibate. He's against the family because he's for the stranger. The stranger is the unfamiliar. When I was down in Los Angeles going to school, lady next to us in our triplex was robbed, gunpoint, guy terrorized her with a shotgun. And when the police came, I was talking to her and helping poor Rosemary. She was just absolutely a basket case. And I said to him, I asked the police officer, I said, what do you recommend, you know, in dealing with these burglaries? Anyway, you know, what? He said, well, it's really hard, really hard. But I have one recommendation. Don't let anybody you don't know in your home. Anyway, when the paper boy comes, don't let him into your house. 75% of the burglaries in Los Angeles are committed by people who've been in your homes. So that's the clue. Yeah, good idea. Makes sense, doesn't it? If we don't have a disgust for the temporal, the things that come to us by way of being a human being, then the cost is not going to be raised for what it is to be a disciple of Jesus. If we're concerned about having the best time here while we're alive, yea, only live once after all. If we're concerned with that, if life is something to be saved, not to be spent, then the cost of following Jesus will not be raised. Kierkegaard thought the only way you can get it raised is to have a healthy disgust for human life. Now try peddling that in your churches. When you get home, ask your pastor, would you do a series on the disgust for human life? Let's look at 6256, entry 62. Oh, no, that's the wrong one. 6932, thank you. Got it. 6932.
Horrible.
It's horrible, yeah. As we all know, a person can get sick from a fetid stench. There are various other disgusting smells which a man cannot bear from which he gets sick. But one can also get sick from stupid nonsense. And just as during plague or cholera the surgeon walks about and chews on something to prevent inhaling, so also one may well have a spiritual need for something in the mouth when one has to work incessantly against stupid nonsense. But there is the difference that for the surgeon inhaling may actually be dangerous, and for the other practitioner it is not harmful, may even be beneficial. For while man by nature wishes for what can give him pleasure in life, the religious person on active duty needs a proper dose of disgust with life. A proper dose of disgust with life. He's not a Manichaean. Manichaean heresy was that all of the temporal is evil. It's wicked. Here he goes, no, God made it. It's wonderful. But it's not the center of your life. It's not that by which you measure your behavior. So you care for it. You take good care of it. You preserve it. But it's not the center of your life. A proper dose of disgust with life in order to be fit for his task. Disgust with life, taken properly, for the way it is used is crucial. That's the thing. Don't be a Manichaean. Don't say it's evil. Just say, it's not the center of my life. It's the best safeguard against getting involved in stupid nonsense. And the stupid nonsense here is following Jesus and keeping all your money, waging in war with delight, and worshiping your family. And then there's 87 other ones that you'll get tomorrow. You know them all. You read them once in your life at least. Once know enough not to read them again. I came upon one that I haven't read for 20 years. And I know why I haven't read it. It said, you got it without paying anything? Give it away without any pay. Well, I know I haven't read that one. Right? If that disgust isn't there, the precondition is not available for raising the cost of being a disciple. Now, I want to look at the thing on joy briefly here. And I guess I handed them all out. I didn't bring my copy. I'm going to have to borrow one here. Remember, Kierkegaard said the Christian has one task, and that is to rejoice always. Let's look at the second page, entry 2177. What is it that sanctifies one's joy? And then we'll look at 2183 on the next page. Look at those two. If a man downcast, troubled, came to you and said, "There is a sorrow which gnaws at my soul, embitters my joy, and makes all the rest of my affliction still more burdensome," and it stood in your power to supply the remedy and to alleviate that sorrow, would you not be right to expect him to find a strength within himself to bear all of his other troubles, so that every time he was dispirited, he could say to himself, however burdensome it may be, "There was one sorrow which lay far more heavily upon my mind, and it was taken away, and therefore I will be happy." Of course, we know that there are in the world many adversities with which one person can greatly help another. But now, if a man's sorrow concerned heavenly things, that's why I part company with Kierkegaard. I bet most of you do too. How much sorrow do you have over heavenly things? Everything we've been told is not to worry about that. That's all taken care of. Okay? Now, if a man, and if it is all taken care of, then you're not going to have the ability to rejoice always, is what he's saying. There's got to be sorrow over heavenly things, or you're not going to be able to rejoice always. See how he develops it? But now, if a man's sorrow concerned heavenly things, if what he strove after was reconciliation and peace with God, how many of you want peace with God? Oh, hell, I've got peace with God. I don't need that. Do you? If what he strove after was reconciliation and peace with God, and if he were now to say to God, "There is one sorrow which robs me of all joy, which makes my life a burden. There's one longing in my soul which devours me if it is not satisfied." And then God, because this man sought relationship with the community which witnesses to a forgiveness of sins, gave him the Spirit's witness also to the forgiveness of his sins, must not a new life stream through him? Must not joy take up residence within him so that in all his sorrow he still must say, "I have nevertheless known a suffering which is more painful than everything which is now happening to me." I sit before my church council and the president tells me I am incompetent. And I get scared. You know why it scares me? Because I'm not afraid of God. If I were afraid of God, nothing would scare me. So that in all this sorrow, he still must say, "I have nevertheless known a suffering which is more painful than everything which is now happening to me. I nevertheless possess a joy which is high above all sorrows, as heaven is above the earth. And even if earth opened to swallow me, I should still see heaven open to receive me." Well, gee, if earth was ready to swallow me, I'd grab as many books as I could. This is Christian joy, not the world's joy. What brings you joy? Fistful of 20s and thousands of dollars in your savings account, good health, healthy, achieving children, in-laws who love you, closet full of clothes, a nice car. Take that away from you. Take that away from me. See how happy I'll be. This is Christian joy, not the world's joy. It is sanctified. Relished in the fleeting moment, anxious lest it suddenly vanish. It is not behind us, as earthly joy always is. Earthly joy is always behind us, but before us, but yet not so far ahead of us that we must say, "Who will climb up to heaven to fetch it down?" No, it is within us. It's ahead of us, but it's in within us. Rejoice always. Rejoice. Again, I say, rejoice in Christ. The only source of joy for the Christian is the death and resurrection of Jesus. That's it. If you wonder why you're not happier, "Pastor, I'm just not a happy person." I said, "Well, your problem probably is that you're not a good enough consumer." I know that's why most of the time I'm not happy. If I could just buy all my clothes from Eddie Bauer, that would do it for me. The anguish in my soul is not over fear of God's judgment on me, but that I'm just not a good enough consumer. I'd much rather have more and better. But how many there are to whom the earthly joy beckoned. Oh, yes, it has beckoned. It's more than beckoned. The call is deafening. And who took it in vain and did not sanctify it? They enjoyed it, and it vanished, and their minds were not open and prepared for heavenly things. Job, as an old man, and he prayed that his children might not forget God in their times of sorrow, suffering? No. They might not forget God in their times of happiness. It's Hosea 13, right? The last chapter in Hosea. God said, remember me, I'm the one whom you cried. And I came down when you're in slavery and I rescued you. And we went across the Red Sea and we went out through the wilderness. We finally got to the land of flowing with milk and honey. And there you sat and ate and were happy and forgot me. Remember that one? Okay, look at 2183. Nevertheless, you can always accomplish something by giving witness to joy. Perhaps you say, how can this be? No one knows what I suffer or what I have suffered. The pathway of my sorrow is solitary and remote, rarely trodden by a traveler. To that I would answer, is it so very important to you that others get to know exactly what you are suffering? Or do you believe that your significance is that you have suffered every possible suffering so that when you yourself have found rest in the world, everything is then resolved? Can you not be satisfied with the common lot of humanity? Could not this still keep the way open? Or do you believe this to be impossible and that no one is able to understand you if he does not know your suffering? The ear of the sufferer is peculiarly formed. Listen carefully now. The ear of the sufferer is peculiarly formed, like the lover's ear, which is trained to hear only the voice of the beloved, although it hears everything else in the world, so also the ear of the sufferer picks up every voice of consolation and recognizes it at once if it is the voice of true consolation. Just as Scripture says that faith and hope without love are only sounding brass and a tinkling cymbal, so also the joy proclaimed without mentioning the pain is only sounding brass and a tinkling cymbal. Unheeded, it whistles past the ear of the suffering one. It sounds on the ear, but it does not resound in the heart. It agitates the ear, but is not treasured within. But this voice, which quivers with pain and still proclaims joy, yes, this forces its way through his ear and descends into his heart and is treasured there. If there's not a proper disgust with life, you will not know the joy of being a Christian. Disgust with life will bring suffering. And it will be a painful suffering. Martin Heineken tells this wonderful story. He's one of the, he's 83 years old and studied Kierkegaard for 50 years and still walks around with a smile on his face saying, Kierkegaard said, Christian has one task, rejoice always. But anyway, Martin tells a story about when he was a pastor in Australia in 1930, and there was a German Lutheran pastor down there, and he used to tell Martin about the suffering he had endured as a Christian. Oh, and Martin tells this in German, and it's really quite funny. He goes, yes, the suffering I must bear is horrible, for after Sunday morning passed, after I had watered the whole flock, serving communion to 500 people, I went home and had this meal with roast and lamb and potatoes and dressing, and then topped it all off with a trifle filled with cream. Not that fluffy stuff, but I mean real rich cream. And I only ate it with one spoon, but I ate it with two spoons. It's so good. And by the time I got done, I was so bloated from all of this that the pain I had to endure was nearly beyond me if I did not know that was the cross I must bear. That's not the suffering we're talking about. We're talking about giving up something that hurts. Your possessions. Your worship of your family and your friends, and your lust for war. When America bombed Libya, Ronald Reagan was never more popular than that day. Came close when he invaded Grenada, but not nearly what he got when he bombed the hell out of Libya. When we heard about how those bombers flew low that night, the infrared devices, and went over the compound of Gaddafi, we wished there had been another bomber there, and they just wiped out that whole damn compound and killed that once and for all. Right? It was in our hearts. It may have been submerged down in there, and we had a bunch of liberal claptrap coming out of our mouths. The fact of the matter, in our hearts, we have that lust for stopping cold those who are our enemies. Give that up, and then you'll suffer. And then you'll hear the joy that is only available in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So says Kierkegaard. And the thing hinges on disgust. And the whole design is that it's a spiritual corrective. It's aimed to make the mind of Christ flourish among us. How odd. How odd that something that it seems so calculated to abuse us. Sometimes I wonder if I'm not masochistic. You know, masochistic people are those who like to hurt themselves. Reading this. Because sometimes you wonder if the thing just isn't aimed at it, trying to abuse us. But the whole idea behind it, the intention behind it, is to bring us face to face with the one who saved us all, to hear his word and to see him, and then to follow, and thereby have the mind of him among us. It's easy to miss the point because the offense and the abuse is so strident. But that's the point. We're not going to look at Judge for Yourself again. Maybe that's just fine for everyone. Tomorrow we'll look at for self-examination. And then we're going to look at the hard sayings of Jesus, and we're going to look at how to study the Bible and how to get face to face with this one who is calling for a spiritual corrective.